The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, I always said if the UFC made it to 100, I would order a pay-per-view, but who better to talk about the UFC and the world of professional wrestling than our old friend Dave Meltzer, who's on the Subway Fresh Take hotline right now. Dave, what's happening?
Not too much. How you doing, Bill?
You have been covering the UFC for how many years now for Yahoo.com?
2 years for Yahoo, but I've been covering it, for the newsletter since the first event, which was 1993. So I'm one of the few people, I think, who's seen, it's not really 100, it's like 133 shows, but I've seen all 133 shows.
Yeah, and it goes back a lot further than people remember. I mean, it goes back to the mid-90s, doesn't it?
The first show was 1993 in Denver, and this form of fighting actually goes back to, as best we can tell, the 1920s in Brazil, and I think that there was some form of it starting in the 1980s in Japan as well, you know, before UFC. Although UFC started kind of like spawned off of the Brazilian Vale Tudo fighting that was really popular in the 20s when actually American, believe it or not, it was American pro wrestling stars would go down to Brazil and fight the Gracies.
Right.
Which people don't, you know, most people don't realize that was the birth of it.
Where does Jean-Claude Van Damme's classic movie Bloodsport fit into all this? Because that came out in 1988. He never gets credit for the birth of the UFC.
You know what everyone says is like the first scenes of Enter the Dragon in the 70s. You know, I think that's kind of like some people try to like kind of like link Bruce Lee into the birth of the UFC. So, yeah.
Hey, does this, what's happening this week, because it's getting a ton of mainstream attention. I mean, even more than I thought it would. Does this remind you at all of early 1984 WWF, right after the Sheik beat Backlund, made him submit, and then Hogan beat him, and all of a sudden wrestling just took off?
You know, I mean, you could make comparisons to the first WrestleMania in 85, except we don't got Mr. T or Roddy Piper. Although,
yeah,
if you saw the Spike special with Brock Lesnar and Frank Mir, Frank Mir was pretty damn close to Roddy Piper on that special. I was amazed.
Did he have coconuts?
Yeah, it wasn't like that, but I mean, just the talking. I mean, he didn't do the racial stuff like Roddy Piper did, but when he, the stuff he did on making fun of Brock Lesnar as a pro wrestler, it was incredible stuff. If you were a wrestling fan, the countdown to UFC show that aired Tuesday on Spike, and it'll air a couple more times this week, that is probably the best one-hour pro wrestling show of the last 10, 15 years,
wow,
believe it or not. I mean, interview-wise, there's nothing on WWF or TNA that can touch it. Can touch
right.
With Frank Mir and Michael Bisping? Oh, no way.
So when do you think that UFC started to grasp that whole, a little bit of the pro wrestling element of the guys trash-talking and emphasizing the personalities and those kind of things?
Well, you know, the original owners, Semaphore Entertainment Group, had no, in 1993, they had no inclination of making this into a sport. So, I mean, they wanted it, you know, they thought that they were, you know, the new form of pro wrestling when they first got the thing. So they embraced it from the very beginning. When they sold it in 2001, you know, you had the Fertittas and Dana White who came more from the boxing side. So they wanted a more exciting version of boxing. You know, they got, you know, they didn't really grow up. I don't know if Lorenzo Fertitta was ever a wrestling fan. Dana White was in the Superfly Snuka age, but it was one of those things like a lot of kids, you know, you watch it for 2 or 3 years and, you know, he was a boxing guy. Although his matchmaker was a huge wrestling fan. So I don't think they really hit on it until 2006, which was really when their business took off.
And what happened? Was there a tipping point?
Well, I think, what turned their business around was the Ultimate Fighter reality show.
Right.
And, you know, so that just, you know, they were on television. You know, when you're trying to promote stuff like an event like that and you have no television, you're very limited in who you can promote to. Once you got television, you know, it changes the whole dynamic. So they were successful as soon as they got television. But they really turned the corner in 06, and that was the Ken Shamrock, Tito Ortiz feud on Ultimate Fighter. You know, Ken Shamrock is a pro wrestler. Tito Ortiz grew up wanting to be a pro wrestler. Their whole rivalry was, you know, I mean, it was real and it wasn't real at the same time. And yeah, that was really when they started hitting like the huge television numbers and the huge pay-per-view numbers. From that program.
What's interesting to me about just kind of following it from afar, because I'm not, I won't pretend to be a UFC aficionado. I've definitely been interested in it, but I haven't gotten to the point where I've been ordering pay-per-views. I've seen some of the Spike shows, but it seems like there's been a few times where a guy seemed like he was ready to break through and even did a little bit, but then just couldn't keep the momentum. I think Chuck Liddell is probably the best example of that. Tito Ortiz, it seemed like he was going to be huge, and then he kind of tapered off. Why haven't they been able to just have like the Hulk Hogan 1984 guy just blow
well,
up?
Well, it's the nature of what it is. The advantage that Vince McMahon has is that when he has Hulk Hogan or The Rock, he can make sure that they never look bad. You know, as far as in the scripting, I mean, unless they can look bad, but it's a different kind of looking bad. But in UFC, there's no control once the cage, you know, shuts. And everyone's going to lose because there's too many. It's not like boxing where if you're the better boxer, you're probably going to win most of the time. In this, because you're combining boxing, wrestling, jiu-jitsu, kickboxing, all of these elements, there's always going to be someone better in one of those elements than you. And sooner or later, you know, even the best is going to lose and you know, lose in a devastating way. So, and also your shelf life, you know, it's real athletics. You know, Hulk Hogan, they could wheel him out there at 56. And, you know,
and they have,
and people go for it, you know, but in, you know, there in MMA, you know, you're not going to have any 56 year old guys. You're really, I mean, you know, you do got Randy Couture past 40, but he's going to be the exception. I mean, people think that because they see him, everyone goes, well, Randy's doing it 45, 46. I can do it, but you can't. I mean, really, most of these guys, when they get to their late 30s, they're pretty much on their way out.
Do you see deterioration with guys like that's pretty obvious, like you do with boxing, where somebody just takes a knockout and
Absolutely.
They're never the same?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's that aspect of it's going to end up being, I mean, the long-term part of that is going to be similar to that of boxing and kind of a mix between boxing and pro wrestling. I'm kind of, you know, I don't know which one's better. You know, I mean, the boxing of the mental deterioration and the pro wrestling, you've got all the young deaths, and I don't know. But they're going to be a mix between the two.
Yeah, but they've done a pretty good job of keeping the PEDs out of this, haven't they?
They've done as good a job as the commissions. You know, it's a commission thing because they're regulated by commission. So they, you know, the commissions test the day of the show as far as, you know, they're not testing year-round much. I can't say that they're doing the best job possible. It isn't as good as, like, U.S. track and field or anything like that or even – probably as good as the NFL, honestly. But if the guys get caught, I mean, they're suspended for 9 months to a year. And for these guys, you know, unless you're a top guy, 9 months to a year without being able to fight, that's pretty devastating because, you know, the money isn't gigantic unless you're a top guy.
Now, why isn't the money gigantic? It would seem like the money should be trickling in by now.
The top guy, it's like boxing. The top guys are doing very well. You know, the ones who have the percentage of the pay-per-views, they can make $1 million, you know, and $2 million even a fight. And, you know, the guys on this one, you know, I would say the main eventers are going to be $2 million plus, you know, when they get their pay-per-view percentage all worked in. But, you know, not on that. Their guarantees are actually pretty low, and the top guys are paid on pay-per-view percentage. And the other guys, they're not the big draws. I mean, they do, you know, they can do well. And I think they're, you know, there's a lot of bonuses thrown around that people don't know about. The guy, you know, you have a lot of guys on the roster that are making, you know, 100,000 in that range. Some guys may be making 200. You know, if you're not a top guy, you're probably not making more than that, though.
What kind of pay-per-view numbers are they expecting for this one?
Yeah, the predictions I heard are 1.3 million, which I can buy. You know, it might even do a little bit better than that.
Isn't that fantastic?
Well, it would be. I expect it to be the largest non-boxing pay-per-view event in history. The biggest pro wrestling was a couple years ago when Donald Trump and Vince McMahon put up their hair. So that was 1.25 million. So this, and UFC has come over a million, or right at a million a couple of times now, but they've never gotten to, you know, 1.2 yet. And I think this one will do that. I think this will go, you know, we'll break that mark. Yeah, their pay-per-view business is fantastic. Last year, UFC beat any year of WWE or any year of professional boxing in history on pay-per-view. So it was the biggest year of any single organization in pay-per-view history.
Wow. And, you know, I've thought this for the last couple of years. The biggest advantage UFC has is that, unlike boxing, where if the main event sucks, you're out $50, and this seems to happen maybe 4 out of every 5 times. UFC, it doesn't matter if the main event sucks because you're always going to get 2 or 3 good fights, right?
Usually. I would say that you're talking about 7 to 8 shows out of 10 are good. You're going to have your stinker. Before, the stinkers used to be worse because when they would run, like, let's say they'd run 5 shows a year, if you had a stinker, you know, you had to dwell on it for 3 months. Oh, God, it was just terrible. Now, when you come back in 2 weeks, you know, very rare you're going to get 2 bad ones in a row. But, you know, every year there's going to be every year there's a couple of bad ones, but the number of good ones usually outweigh them.
Are you surprised by how the sentiment has changed toward UFC? Because I remember, like, you know, even I went to a card in 2002, and it was pretty violent. And one guy really got messed up, and I left with a buddy of mine, and we were both like, wow, I don't know if that, you know, if moments like that are going to happen, I don't know if it makes it. Right around 2004, 2005, there was a little bit of a shift, but I know, like, you know, ESPN was probably looking at getting involved with this for 3-4 years and was just afraid because it was too violent, too grisly, all this stuff. And now it's an enterprise. What changed?
I think just being on television, and just the more you see it, the first time you see it, the things like taking a guy down and punching him in the face. I mean, we never saw that in, they say it's like a combination of sports, but that's the one element. You know, there's none of that in judo. There's none of that in boxing. There's none of that in wrestling. You can take the guy down, but you don't take a guy down and punch him in the face. And I think that if you didn't grow up with that, you look at that and go, that's barbaric. That's not right, because we're used to certain rules of combat.
Yeah.
And now that you've seen it for 3-4 years, that's just our rules of combat, and it's not considered, you know, barbaric anymore. I mean, I remember I used to watch that with some people, you know, in the let's say late 90s, you know, and then that was the thing where they would do that and they would get all turned off and just like, But now when people have seen it for 5 years, and people now you got kids who grew up with it, and, you know, they watch this instead of boxing, you know, and the boxing thing is just, you know, why do they just box? I mean, it's so limited, you know, it's a completely different mentality, from the previous generation, because there was a period in 06 when it really took off, because I was actually doing the MMA writing for the LA Times at the time. And what I was told was that everyone on the staff under 40 would go, why aren't you doing more coverage of this? And everyone over 40 was, why are we doing any coverage of this? So it was kind of like a generational thing. And it still is to an extent.
I can tell you that was the case at ESPN.
Yeah.
Because I know there were some people really pushing for us to get involved, because at that time you could have gotten it for a song, you know? And I think there was another generation that just thought, this is barbaric. This isn't our brand. But really, like, what is your brand? Your brand is your young males, right? So this actually, in a weird way, kind of was your brand. This is where things were going. I also wonder if, like, culturally, we've changed a little bit. You know, our culture is a little more in your face, and you can kill people on message boards and stuff like that, or YouTube. You can see any clip of anybody or whatever, and UFC doesn't seem so out of place anymore. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, and the other one is like Dana White's, in some sense, you know, like Dana White's a perfect example as far as that mentality, because older guys who I know who grew up with, you know, Pete Rozelle or Roger Goodell or whatever, you know, they look at Dana White and go, how can this guy be the commissioner of a sports league? He talks the way he does and all that. But younger people, like, they're really drawn to him. You know, he's a real character himself.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking about getting into it. I really am. And, you know, if I hadn't gone on that 2002 card, it would have happened a lot sooner. I can't tell you how much that put me out to see this guy just, like, his face wreck, get carried off. I was like, all right, I think I'm – but you know, I'm back, I think, maybe.
It's going to happen. I mean, I'll tell you, you know, like, I went to most of the shows the last year, and there are moments, not on every show, but every third or fourth show, there's that moment where a guy takes something and you get really concerned, and thankfully – you know, there's never been that level of a tragedy. But, I mean, I've seen guys down for several minutes. And, you know, I mean, Chuck Liddell in Atlanta, a little over, you know, whatever it was, end of 07, I think it was.
Right.
Oh, my, you know, it was like, that was, or it was 08, I think. But, you know, when that happened, You know, I mean, I'd say this for Dana White, because I talked to him right afterwards. I mean, he was very concerned about it. And, you know, he went to Chuck Liddell, you know, and just said, look, you know, I don't want you to fight anymore, because I don't want to see you like that anymore. And Chuck begged him for one last fight. He had one last fight. He lost. And then Dana just goes, you know, we got an agreement. And I don't know, you know how fighters are. He may fight again anyway, but you know, I mean, he's just one, you know, and this is his biggest drawing card. That was a real big thing to me as far as being impressed by White, because I've never seen a boxing promoter take, you know, their biggest drawing card when they can still draw and just say, look, for the better, you know, for your own health, you know, I want to bench you now.
Yeah.
You know, it's very unusual.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've been waiting for the last 5 years for some sort of tragedy, because I really think, like, we're going to find out once and for all if UFC is here to stay, if they can avoid some sort of, or not avoid, but if some sort of really bad thing happens in the cage, and then people kind of grieve it and react to it, and the typical people come in and say, this is terrible, this is human cockfighting, and if they can survive that, I think that's the final stage.
Well, it will. You know, it's amazing to me in 16 years. I mean, because there have been, I think, two deaths that I'm aware of on small shows, you know. But with the number of fights that there have been, you know, because now, I mean, like here in, like, California, I mean, there's you know, as much MMA as there is boxing, maybe more. You know, there's stuff every weekend. It really does impress me that there have been so few, but inevitably there is going to be a death on a live UFC show. It may take 25 years, but it will happen. And you're right, at that point, then what happens?
We'll find out.
Yeah.
So, all right, so let's say I love this card that I'm about to pay-per-view on Saturday night. What three essential things do I need to know about getting into the UFC?
Well, you know, you grew up as a wrestling fan, so especially older wrestling fans make the transition to this pretty good, because with the exception of the actual product being different, the nature of the booking is the same, as far as, you know, like, you know, you see guys built up. And, you know, they go from prelims, they win, and they move to main events and that type of thing. And, you see the whole growth period, and then you see the whole decline period as well. And in some cases, the interviews are the same, and in some they're a little bit less theatrical. And some, you know, you've got – basically, when you watch the TV, you learn who the characters are, and it's the characters that sell. You know, people think it's the fighting, but it's the exact – what draws is the same thing that drew for Bruno Sammartino. It's the characters. You know, it isn't the two greatest fighters fighting each other that draws the most, you know, pay-per-view buys. It's the two most over characters. In the case of Mir, you know, I mean, Mir did the total pro wrestling build-up, and Lesnar's a former pro wrestler, so he's got the pro wrestling fan base, you know, that wants to see him kill Mir, and then the MMA fans. What's really good about this program is that you've got an MMA fan base, the hardcore fan base of MMA, and to an extent, but not as much, the hardcore fan base of pro wrestling. I think that there's kind of this rivalry and kind of hatred of each other, because I think that the MMA fan base grew up with pro wrestling so much more popular, and you know, just this thing of those guys are fake. And then the pro wrestling fan base grew up with pro wrestling as the king, and there was nothing else. And now all of a sudden, MMA is actually in some circles. In much of the country, it's more popular than pro wrestling. And it's kind of like this resentment that they're pulling people out, and it's actually real, too. And the Lesnar-Mir fight, what's great about that is you've got a former pro wrestling star who's actually, a fantastic athlete and a good fighter, who kind of, to some people, represents pro wrestling. And Mir's certainly taking that tact by insulting the pro wrestling. It's not fake. You know, it's like, this isn't the WWE, the punches are real type of buildup. And so you got those wrestling fans all inflamed because they're bigger, stronger guys. They want to see him kill Frank Mir. But the MMA fans, it's kind of the opposite. They want to see that pro wrestler get humiliated. So that's a major part of the lure of Lesnar and Mir the first time, and it's even stronger the second time, because the first fight they had, Lesnar came out and destroyed him for 88 straight seconds, on the verge of beating him, made a rookie mistake. And Mir submitted him. So you got the MMA fans, that stupid pro wrestler. He didn't know the first thing. You walked right into an ankle lock or knee bar. And then you've got the pro wrestling fans, like, if he hadn't have made that mistake, he would have killed that guy. He was killing the whole fight. So It was a great first fight for building up a second fight.
This is great. You just got me so excited for the rematch. I'm fired up now. I'm in the wrestling fan camp. I'm going to root for Brock Lesnar.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like I should be. That's my camp.
Yeah, I mean, the wrestling fans who watched that Spike special, they want to see Frank Mir get killed. But in the building, you know, partially because Frank Mir's a Las Vegas guy and the fight's in Las Vegas, Brock's getting booed out of the place. We know, the first time, what was so interesting about that fight, too, is that you had Kurt Angle, Steve Austin, Undertaker, JBL, all sitting at ringside. Hmm. So you almost, and they just came because they wanted to come. It wasn't like, you know, Vince McMahon was involved in that. I'm sure he probably wished they didn't go, honestly, but they went. So you had that dynamic in the building. But what was so funny is like they hated the pro wrestling. Okay, this is this whole audience, right? They hated the pro wrestling. But all the time, I mean, they've had, you know, celebrity after celebrity at UFC that I've been going. And the two most popular celebrities, bar none, number one was Steve Austin, number two was Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Wow.
As far as the crowd goes crazy when they come out. So it's like they're all those, you know how when you grew up with the closet wrestling fan thing, it's like, oh, I never watched that stuff, yet they know everybody and who they were, you know, and all the programs.
Yeah.
I think that there's a lot of that in the UFC audience. Like, I don't like that stuff, it's pro wrestling, but they see, there's Steve Austin, oh my God, and, you know, and it's like, there's movie stars in there, you know, that are Oscar winners in the crowd, and they walk right by him, they don't even care, but Steve Austin was like the biggest deal that they ever had, or Kurt Angle, when he came out, there was like, you know, it was like a real superstar came down.
Wow. Is there a Tiger Woods or a Roger Federer type in UFC right now, potentially?
George St. Pierre, who's in the semi-main, probably.
And he's a welterweight, right?
He's the welterweight champion. I wouldn't go so far as Tiger Woods, but he's probably pound for pound the best guy in the company. And he's this great all-around athlete and, you know, just, you know, French-Canadian, nice guy, and he's fighting a guy who might beat him because the guy's – that's the whole chess thing in the sense. St. Pierre is the better all-around fighter of the two, okay? He's better conditioned, better all-around fighter. However, Thiago Alves has better stand-up, and he's got good takedown defense. So if George St. Pierre can do what he usually does, which is take guys down and just beat them up and out-condition them, he'll win this fight. But if Alves can keep it standing, if his takedown defense is good enough and George has to fight him standing up, Alves, who's not as good a fighter as George, has a very good chance of winning the fight, which is one of the things about it's styles, it's the way the styles match up that make the fight, and you can have A beat B, B beats C, but then C goes and beats A, you know, because of the way they match up stylistically.
Oh, it's like kind of like boxing a little bit where you have the rock, paper, scissors type thing.
Yeah, but more, because this is more unpredictable. I mean, I'm not even a big boxing aficionado, but I watch the fights, and I'm a huge MMA fan, and I can predict boxing a lot better than MMA.
Really?
I mean, most people, I mean, you get the best experts in MMA. If you're doing 58% right, you know, you're doing good. I mean, it's a pretty darn hard, you know, because anything can happen. You can dominate a fight in every aspect of the game and just lapse for a second and get kneed in the chin, you know, and you're out. Or you can lapse for a second and someone will grab your ankle and you're done. You never know where, you know, guys come from behind all the time, you know, because the guy on top kind of go, I'm winning, everything's cool, I'm fine, lapses for a second, and it's already over.
So Vegas must love UFC, you're telling me. If it's that unpredictable, that means they're making money.
The betting, I mean, I actually read an article on it. The betting is grown by leaps and bounds in the last year, but it's still, like, the betting for this event would be equivalent to the best football game on a weekend during the regular season, you know, but okay, not of all the NFL games. So it would be like, you know, whatever it is, like, for this, but this is the biggest event in history. So it's not like football betting or college football betting or basketball betting yet. But, I mean, in the future, you know, I mean, it is the biggest growth sport for betting in the last year in Vegas.
Lesnar is a -230 favorite.
Yeah, too long odds. I mean, I'm not saying I would favor Lesnar, but it's like I favor him, you know, 60%. And that's too, in St. Pierre and Alves as well. I mean, the odds are too long. I mean, but the thing is that I think that they look at the thing where most of the people are going to look at Lesnar, and number one, they're going to see that he beat the hell out of the guy until he made a mistake the first time, and now he's got 17 months more experience, and he's looked good in his last couple fights, and he's the bigger, stronger, faster, better, more athletic guy. So I think a lot, you know, they're going to bet on that, but it's not an absolute. The thing that in UFC betting is people who have made the most money traditionally bet the underdogs, not because the underdogs win most of the time, but because the odds are too long. You know, people, they get these 2 and 3 to 1 odds, and it's very rarely a real 3 to 1 fight. It's like, you know, it's like really a 60-40, 65-35 fight.
Well, it seems like if that, like St. Pierre is a minus 300, so it seems like the smart move would be to bet Frank Mir plus 180 and then the Pitbull at plus 220 and hope to hit one of them, right?
Absolutely, because one of them could win. And Henderson Bisping I would run from, though, because that one, you know, even though Henderson's a pretty big favorite, I mean, Bisping could win, but I'm having a hard time visualizing that happening.
Is there a young up-and-coming star that is going to break out on this card? I like the guy who's nicknamed the Doberman.
What?
It's a nice name. There's a guy nicknamed the Doberman. I like that nickname.
I'm not sure even which one that was.
CB the Doberman Dalloway.
Oh, CB, yeah. He's in the prelim, so his fight may or may not make the pay-per-view.
Oh.
He was an Arizona State wrestler. But Johnny Bones Jones is
another
probably,
great name.
Yeah,
I like
he's,
that.
He's like 21. He's probably the guy, and you'll like him because Johnny Bones Jones is this great athlete. He was like a junior college national champion in wrestling. But the thing with him, and then he didn't even go to a major college. He just went to this. So his wrestling's very good. But he's a guy who, I don't know where he gets everything from, but he throws like all kinds of pro wrestling moves and video game fight moves in his matches just because he's so athletic he can actually do them.
Hmm.
You know, so I think that from an entertainment standpoint, he's a he's a guy to watch.
Well, I'll tell you, just the fact that Johnny Bones Jones is fighting Irish Jake O'Brien, that's worth $50 right there. What a matchup of great nicknames.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is when Johnny Bones Jones wrestled Bonner, I mean, he was doing these belly to belly suplexes, and he was doing stuff between wrestling moves, roller derby moves, and video game moves. I mean, that was his whole fight. It was. People were just going like, "What? This stuff doesn't work in a real fight." He's doing it all.
What kind of celebrities can we expect on Saturday night?
I don't know. I mean, you know, there's always some, but I haven't asked. A couple weeks ago, The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, told me he was going, but I haven't heard from him in a month, so you know that's hit or miss. He may be there, but as far as who else, Mandy Moore's there a lot. David Spade's there all the time, and he walks through people and they don't even know who he is. It's kind of funny, you know.
He's so tiny.
Yeah, so there's David Spade, and he's just like walking through, like, you know.
What about athletes?
I've seen Shaquille O'Neal at a lot of shows. Tyson will almost surely be there. He's at most of them. Michael Jordan's been there before, but hidden away. Michael Jackson was there once under a mask, believe it or not. Do you know that story?
No.
At UFC 84, there was a guy in a wheelchair just covered from head to toe. You know, kind of like, you probably never saw this one, but when Andy Kaufman did this in Memphis once with Jerry Lawler, where
I saw it.
The mummy thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's like sitting there in this wheelchair all covered from head to toe, and no one knew who he was. They just thought he was, you know, like one of those, you know, a burn victim child. Later, I found out it was Michael Jackson.
Wow. That's crazy. I always loved the Kaufman Lawler. There was a documentary that I remember, like Comedy Central showed at one point a long time ago, that was kind of about the Kaufman Lawler thing, but I always thought that would have been a great documentary.
Yeah. When that was going on, I thought that that was really cool stuff because Kaufman didn't really get pro wrestling, but he was so naturally good at it anyway, you know, as far as just people hating him. Because, like, I just remember Jimmy Hart would tell me the story about how they did the famous thing in Memphis where, he got knocked out with a pile driver and he went to the hospital and everyone, you know, went on the TV with a neck brace and everything. He came back and, you know, they did something similar. And he just laid there and just goes, "I'm going to do it again." And Jimmy Hart goes, "You can't do it again." And he goes, "It worked so well the first time." He goes, "But this time they'll know if you do the exact same thing the second time, it won't, it can't work twice." And he didn't understand why it wouldn't work the second time.
Well, yeah, I remember when he went on Letterman, and I actually watched it when it happened. But when Lawler slapped him and Kaufman just lost his crap.
That was awesome.
It was really one of the best wrestling things that's ever been pulled off. I was completely convinced it was real. And to this day, you might even be able to convince me it was real.
It wasn't, though.
I know, but I mean, you could have talked me into it. Let's talk about wrestling, because the last time I had you on was 2 years ago, And I don't know why it's been that long. It's my fault. But it was right after Chris Benoit died. And both of us were kind of thought that maybe this was going to be it for the WWE and that it was just going to maybe be the downfall to some degree. And that hasn't happened. Why hasn't that happened?
Fans are super resilient. I don't think right now, just because they're kind of like a monopoly promotion and there's so many people who just, you know, there's something about pro wrestling that appeals to enough people. I don't think, you know, even when they do bad, they're going to do okay. Plus, the nature of the business has changed so much. It's a much, much easier business to make money in than ever before because, like, you get TV money. Because before wrestling, you used to have to pay to be on TV, or they would go with, you know, even we'll supply you with the tape. And, you know, we'll keep, you know, the TV station will keep the commercial money, and you're happy because you sell your house, you know, your arena business out of it. Now, I mean, Vince gets TV money not just in this country, but from all these overseas countries by sending the tape out. So he doesn't have to rely on just the pay-per-view money and just the house show revenue. And plus, you know, the merchandise is everywhere, and the merchandise is, you know, the merchandise is actually the biggest profit center of the company, more than the live events themselves.
That's interesting. I also, they must be raking it in on those DVDs, because now they own the library of basically every wrestling match that's ever happened.
Yeah, that's the other big profit thing. The thing with the DVDs, though, is that they're, there's a finite number of ways they can package that old stuff, and they pretty much, I mean, they're not there yet. They've got several years to go, but like 3-4 years, they're going to hit the wall. You know what I mean? You can only do, you know, every star once or twice, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, the fourth Ric Flair DVD, which they're on, you know, people kind of, you know, it kind of gets, it's not going to sell like the first three. And, you know, they've done everyone except for Macho Man, which just came out this one. And I mean, that was the one, because Vince McMahon and Macho Man, you know, Vince hates him with a passion like no one else.
Yeah.
And when I saw that he did Macho Man, it's like, man, they are out of ideas. Because you know, that was the one that, you know, every year when they would have the meetings of, like, what ideas we're going to do, and it was always like, we're going to do a Macho Man DVD, and then they set it all in motion, and then Vince looks at the thing. Wait a minute. Someone's approved this? It's not happening. And this year he let it go. So that tells me they're running low on ideas.
Well, I am a grateful recipient of the DVDs because somehow I got on their mailing list, and they show up in the mail, and I got that Macho Man DVD probably like a month or 5 or 6 weeks ago. I can't remember. But every time they come in the mail, my wife flips out. She just, no! Oh, no! Oh, you got another one! And so I got Macho Man and Greatest Tag Teams showed up within the last 5 weeks, and it was like, all right, honey, you better make other plans tonight. I got to plow through the greatest tag teams ever, which was hosted by The Miz and John Morrison, and it is like off the charts for unintentional comedy with these.
Really?
Two.
Well, you know, those two guys are good. I mean, I'm kind of a fan of The Miz because he's kind of like this, you know, cool. He's cool, but he's still kind of a geek at the same time.
Mm. Well, you're not going to be as much of a fan watching them read off cue cards and announcing tag team matches for 2 hours.
Well, you know what is funny is that when they have the younger guys talk about the old stuff, and it's clear that they have no clue what they're talking about.
Right.
I mean, I've seen some of that. Like, you know, they'll have one of the pretty girls, and they'll have them host the DVD talking about some wrestler from 25 years ago, and it's just like, you know, number one, they weren't born, and number two, they have no clue.
Yeah. This Miz thing has been amazing because, you know, he's from the real world. He was a guy who was on the real world and then a frequent participant on the Real World Road Rules Challenge and always dreamed of and talked about becoming a wrestler and had a shtick. And now he's actually a tag team champion. I can't get over it.
Yeah. You know, he did pretty well. He went through their Tough Enough thing, which was the reality show, and he took second. And he actually, you know, and they wanted him to win. You know, I mean, it was a real funny story. I mean, as soon as he came in, because he had the name from Real World, they wanted him to win. And the people, you know, and they didn't vote for him last week. They voted for the other guy by a pretty big margin. Yeah. And but you know, he ended up making it through. You know, he spent a couple of years in developmental. His interviews are pretty good. Wrestling is okay. You know. Not too much below average. I mean, I wouldn't say he's a great wrestler. The thing that was good with him and Morrison is that Morrison's a great athlete, so they complemented each other well. But in typical WWE fashion, they have since broken up, and they have nothing to do with each other. And maybe they'll do better as singles. We'll see. That's the mentality is they're both going to do good in singles, and we'll see.
They don't like to keep the tag team. But, you know, the worst thing that ever happened was, although it was one of the iconic wrestling moments, but when Michaels kicked Marty Jannetty through the barbershop window, before that happened, the tag teams used to stay together for years, you know? And if they broke up, it was a big deal. Now they break up in like 8 months.
Yeah. Well, you can't. Well, now they're put together for 3 weeks and break up half the time. But
yeah.
The thing, you can't complain about that one because Michaels ended up doing a lot better than he would have if he stayed.
No,
with
I know. It was time for him to do it, but I think it set the fire in Vince's brain that, oh, this is great. I'm just going to have tag teams turn against each other over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But actually, like having Mr. Fuji and Mr. Saito there when I was growing up was a nice thing.
Yeah.
I didn't want them to turn on each other.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with Miz and Morrison, which is how bad it's gotten, is they did a thing where they turned on each other, and then they never even wrestled each other. They put them in separate programs.
Well,
so it's kind of like, you know, it's like sometimes I watch it and I go, do you remember why? It's like, do you remember why you do interviews, and do you remember why you do, like, feuds? It's like they'll break people up, and then they don't even wrestle each other. It's like, do you remember why in the old days you used to break people up?
Well, I mean, the ultimate ever, I think, was probably San Martino Zabisco, because when that happened, that was a watershed moment. This was like, I can't believe he hit him with the chair. I just can't believe it. Like, you're like having a heart attack. It just, I can't even come up with a comparison. It would be like Kobe hitting Phil Jackson with a steel chair or something.
But I mean, that's one of the things that the value of patience in wrestling that they don't have anymore is, the reason that worked was because Zabisco started in 72, and this was 1980 when it happened, so it's 8 years of him being Bruno's little protege, and then he turns on Bruno, you know, of course, who'd been the top star for, you know, 20 years.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was huge. And it's the same thing with Hogan and Andre, is when Andre finally turned heel, you know, which was 87, he'd been a babyface for 14 years when he made the turn. So when he made the turn, that was huge. Now, like, they rush things. They would have, if San Martino and Zabisco, if that thing was around now, and this is not an exaggeration, they would probably do the turn within 2 months, maybe three
right.
at the most. And it wouldn't work because there'd be no long-term, you know, thing. And it'd just be seen as, you know, just another thing. And they would go out and they would go to the house shows and it would draw absolutely no extra people, you know.
Right.
That's just how it's changed.
The other thing that really helped was Bruno did one of the great blade jobs, I think, in the history of wrestling. He was bleeding like a stuck pig. You really thought like he really did get belted by the chair, and he actually might have. I don't even know, but man, you saw that blood combined with Zabisco turning on him, and that might be my favorite heel turn, other than when Macho finally turned on Hulk.
Yeah, Macho on
Friday
and
Night SmackDown or whatever it was called, Friday Night Fight. What was it
Friday
called?
Friday Night Friday Main Event on NBC.
But the Friday
Macho,
Main Event.
The Macho and Hulk was built up for a year.
Yes, and we were all waiting
coming,
for it.
But it was one of the great buildups ever. San Martino and Zabisco, even though it was built up for about a month or two, in the end, I think people deep down didn't expect it. Whereas Hogan and Savage, everyone's going, he's going to do it, and then he did it. But, I mean, they had that whole year storyline, so people understood where it was coming from over Elizabeth. And, you know, it was a real well-done thing in a different way.
You know what? I kind of agree with the Macho Man. The Hulk had jealous eyes. We all saw it. But they had, like, for four straight years, they just had people turn on Hogan.
Yeah.
It was like, hey, Mr. Don't turn your back on Mr. Wonderful. No! And then that's just the way it went, really. But I thought the Hulk, maybe the finest acting, I'll even put it above No Holds Barred, finest acting of his career during the Macho Man.
With the one where he's asking for a countdown before the...
the jealous eyes and then carrying Elizabeth, all that stuff. It was great. You know, I was watching that Macho Man DVD and I have two different. I have my favorite wrestlers ever and then who I think were the greatest wrestlers ever. And the greatest to me were, all, you know, it's like anything else. It's the guys who can put the other guys over. Those guys go to another level. And Ric Flair, that's why he's the greatest, because he could not have a bad match with anybody. And I had Macho second and Shawn Michaels third. But after this last WrestleMania, I move Michaels above Macho, because if you can get a good match out of the freaking Undertaker at this stage of his career, you deserve to be number two.
Well, Undertaker's pretty good for knowing what to do and everything. But Shawn Michaels is one of the best I've ever seen. I mean, he's up there. In some ways, he's better than Flair, but the difference to me is that Flair did it longer, and also Flair did it at, I mean, when I used to go to see Ric Flair at a house show, you know, in front of 2,000 people or 4,000 people or 5,000 people, you got the same Matt, you got the same Ric Flair that you got in front of 15. And when I would see Sean at a house show, it was like, and he was never bad. He was always good, but he was not the Shawn Michaels you saw on pay-per-view. And I'm not saying that's bad because, it's, you know, everyone does that now because you know that you've got your house show routine and your pay-per-view routine, because if you did your pay-per-view routine every night on the road, you know, you would die. But somehow Ric Flair was able to do that for 20 years, do his pay-per-view routine at house shows, and hold up. I mean, he must have... You know, some guys are lucky they don't get hurt is what it is. I mean, even though Flair's, you know, I mean, I say that Flair's had a broken neck and he's broken his ankle and things like that. But for a wrestler, Ric Flair actually has not been hurt very much considering how much he's done. And that is probably the reason that he was able to do what he did. Whereas Shawn, you know, Shawn's got the bad knees and the bad back and had him at a very young age. You know, he did as much as he could physically do. Ric is just more durable than most and almost anyone.
And you know what? Durability and the ability to avoid injury is never factored enough into whenever somebody's having an all-time discussion. You know, because it's pretty easy to be good for a year or 2 years or 3 years. But when you're just banging out year after year after year like Flair did, I don't ever remember wrestling without Ric Flair for like 25 years. He never went away. You know, yeah. Michaels disappeared for – we all thought his career was over.
Yeah, he disappeared for four plus years.
How did he come back? Have we ever figured that out?
He rested for 4 years. He came back. I remember when he came back, it was like maybe one match, maybe two. And he had a great first match back. And it's like, wow, first match back for a guy with a bad back. He was doing all kinds of crazy things. It's like, you know, maybe he'll do two or three. You know, a couple months later, he's on the road. And he's there every week.
Yeah, but he's got, I mean, it's not like you can't improve a bad back. You can kind of live with it. But for wrestling, I don't understand how he's doing this.
Yeah, he's feeling it, though. I mean, he's like right now sitting at home, and he's probably going to be – he wants to sit at home for several more months. Mm. Although SummerSlam's coming, and I'm sure those phone calls are coming. Like, a couple of guys have gone down with injuries just in the last week, Edge and Matt Hardy. So I'm sure that they're going like, oh, man, you know, we're short on stars, Sean. I know that phone call has already happened.
And the offer has been made with dollar figures at the end of it. we're nearing the end of the decade. What would you say – who would you say is the wrestler of the decade?
There isn't a Ric Flair. You know what I mean? So it's hard because the guy who would have been is probably The Rock, but geez, he was out by 2002 for as far as full time.
Right.
So, you know, probably not Michaels. You know, Michaels probably.
I would say Michaels.
Yeah, Michaels maybe. Maybe John Cena, because to me, John Cena was the cat. You know, the thing was going down, you know, after the thing, you know, the peak period to me was like 97, 98 to 2001.
Yep.
And after 2001, after WrestleMania 2001, when they turned Steve Austin, that was one of the most dunderheaded moves in the history of wrestling.
Yep.
Was the Steve Austin heel turn, because their ratings every week went down, their business went down. I mean, it was one of those things where you can point to this moment, and it's like, we screwed up, you know. And even though Steve Austin, people go, but he was a great heel, but it was just not what was going to draw the money. You know, Austin was like Bruno. Like, when Hulk Hogan turned, that was the whole thing, is people go like, well, Hulk Hogan turned. But Hulk Hogan turned when people were sick of him. I mean, they were booing him, and he had no choice but to turn. There was none of that going on with Steve Austin. Steve Austin brought a whole generation into wrestling. And when he turned, it was kind of like, they're our hero, and we're supposed to boo him. We're done, and that's what happened. So from that period till about, geez, I'm thinking 2005, 2006, the thing was going down. You know, at a slow level. You know, it wasn't collapsing, but it was going down every year. And I think John Cena, with his appeal to kids, started the turnaround. And it's not anywhere close to what it was then, but it's doing okay. You know, and you know, the other thing, when we talked about the resiliency, that kid audience, you know, the Benoit thing didn't mean anything to them. I think the Benoit thing meant something to adults, you know, and made it hard for them to watch for a while. But, you know, time heals all wounds. I mean, let's face it, like, NASCAR didn't die when Dale Earnhardt died either, and he was a lot bigger star than Chris Benoit.
What kind of effect, good or bad, did the wrestler have with Mickey Rourke?
I think it had no effect at all. It's a funny story, though, because Vince McMahon saw the movie The Wrestler and hated it, just thought it was horrible. And then it started getting all those awards, and then all of a sudden it was like the WWE started promoting the movie after, you know, it started getting all the awards. They jumped on that bandwagon and brought Mickey Rourke to WrestleMania. But the first meeting, you know, when he thought the movie was just going to be some art house movie going nowhere, it was like, you know, he told everyone, that movie's horrible. So it's kind of a funny story.
Yeah. Do you see anybody challenging them? Any chance?
Vince? Challenging Vince?
Yeah, we're right. Like this TNA or one of these.
They're light years away. The real challenge to Vince is UFC. It isn't TNA. Hmm. You know, the UFC with the guys between 25 and 35. I mean, I've seen it with my own friends. You know, they grow up. I mean, my friends were 20-year wrestling fans, and it's not that they don't like wrestling, but damn, they're all into UFC and wrestling, and WWE is very secondary to them.
Do they like each other or they dislike each other, the two sides, UFC versus fans?
I don't really know. I think they don't like badmouth each other much. I mean, like when the only thing I remember was there was when UFC started hitting big with Lesnar, I think that there was that thing of from WWE, it's like, oh my God, they took our guy that we created and they're making... You know, Lesnar drew more for money for UFC than he ever did for WWE, but WWE is the one who created that monster. So I think that after one of his pay-per-views, I think it was the one where he beat Couture for the championship, WWE put something on their website and said, well, you know, because the, you know, they during a UFC pay-per-view, you get five matches on a UFC pay-per-view live, and if the matches go short, which they usually do, you'll usually get anywhere from, you know, one to three or four of the prelim matches will add on, which is fine. That's what you want to see more matches.
Yeah.
And they didn't understand that, and they said because the big fights were so short, you know, they had to add meaningless prelim matches to this pay-per-view. And they kind of like made this snide remark on the show, and the show did huge business. And they got so much negative reaction, they pulled the story like a day later because they knew that they screwed up with you know, saying, you know, like trying to mock them for running too many matches on, you know, meaningless
right.
matches that were actually good matches on the pay-per-view. So that was the only public thing. I mean, like from a public standpoint, WWE gets asked about UFC constantly, and their thing is, you know, we're their sport, we're entertainment, we're not in competition. However, there's...
I don't agree.
Yeah, well, but I mean, the thing is as I say... when they send out their little internal memos every week on tracking stuff, they track TNA and they track UFC as their competition. So internally, and I know that there was a guy who is from another country who does both the WWE and announcing for WWE and UFC, and when he came to one of the shows, they viewed him as a traitor because he was hired also as a UFC announcer. So internally, the thing with them was in 06, Vince McMahon was, I mean, he was aware of this, but he really wasn't that aware. And Stephanie McMahon, Triple H, you know, his inner circle, they have no interest in it at all. Now, Shane is a quasi-UFC fan. He's kind of a fan, but whatever. Vince was kind of unaware. So in 06, when Chuck Liddell fought Quentin Jackson, you know, some of the people on the creative team just go, Vince, we have to watch this. You've got to see it. This is like a big thing. So Vince watched it, and this is the peak of Liddell, and Liddell got knocked out in 1 minute, and Vince, when it was over, is going like, well, you know, the main event won 1 minute, and the wrong guy won. They spent all that money marketing Chuck Liddell, and now he's finished, and, he couldn't have been more wrong. And so the office thing, you know, they had a one of the, I think it was Donna Goldsmith, I think it was did a big seminar for one of the business things, and that it always comes up, and she said, you know, that their problem is that they can't make stars. And, you know, the other one is that, you know, like they make, you know, they make a star and they get knocked out and then they're done. And what they don't realize is that, number one, you can get knocked out and you still retain your drawing power because it's the personality that draws, not if you win or lose in UFC, which people don't really understand. And and also, you know, like that unpredictability is part of the lure of the thing. And the fact that the match can end in 1 minute is not a detriment. You know, Vince thought, you know, who's going to pay for a 1 minute match? But the point is you got a whole card and you're getting, you know, 8 or 9 matches. So you're going to get your 15 minute match and you're going to get your 1 minute match. You just don't know which one is it. You know, unlike in wrestling where you always know the main event's going 20 and you always know the women's match is going 4.
Now, knowing Dana White, I am very surprised that he hasn't just thrown down the gauntlet and just scheduled a UFC pay-per-view right against Survivor Series or SummerSlam or something. Basically put it on the table and say, let's see it.
He would be more likely to do that with boxing. Dana White, because of who he is and what his job is, he has incredible admiration for Vince. And you know, if you understand the two guys, he should, because Dana White is the 1980s Vince McMahon.
Yeah.
I mean, and I knew Vince in the 80s a little bit, and I know Dana now pretty well. And he, you know, and I mean, in the company, there was a thing, ESPN, was it ESPN E60, right? They did a thing on Vince before WrestleMania. So I was at a UFC, you know, the next weekend there was a UFC or the week or 2 weeks after, and two different guys that work in that office go up to me and just goes, "Oh my God, I watched that piece on Vince McMahon. That's Dana." And I go, "I've been telling you that for a year now," you know. And it's like they're both workaholics. They're both, you know, they live to show up their adversaries. You know, Vince always does better when he's challenged. You know, by another wrestling group. I mean, the best stuff they ever did was when they were really fighting for their lives with, you know, WCW and WCW was strong.
Late 90s.
Yeah, the late 90s, 97, 98, 99. I mean, that was, you know, 2000, that was the best WWF ever was. WWF was called then.
The only difference between them, though, I would say is that I always felt Vince was just, you read about the stuff that he did in the 80s and just he was so shrewd. And with Dana White, I know he's doing a great job and I know he's the right guy at the right time, but I wonder how much of it is luck and how much of it is savvy? Like, was America just ready for something like this right now?
Well, you know, I always thought when I saw the sport in the 90s, but long before Dana White, I mean, there's, you know, I'm reading all of these history pieces this week, you know, because it's kind of the milestone period, mm-hmm. and they're talking about it. And I feel kind of like when I would read the history pieces from Vince, you know, how Vince took wrestling that was nothing. And it's like, wait a minute, I watched wrestling in the 70s. It was pretty darn popular. Now, don't get me wrong. Vince improved it in a lot of ways and made it popular in different ways. Absolutely. But the point is that if there was no Vince McMahon, pro wrestling would still be very popular today.
Yes.
It would be different because he changed it. But with Dana, I mean, when I watched that, it was like, it's the first guy to get this thing on television is going to do real well. And so he was the first guy. Now, as far as, you know, fighting opposition, they're the same person. I mean, you know, recreating history. They're doing a thing on Spike this all week. They're doing the 100 greatest matches. This is total Vince. The 100 greatest matches in the history of UFC. Every person from the past that Dana White doesn't like is the you know, like Tito Ortiz, let's just as an example. I think, I don't remember his record off the top of my head, but let's just say it's 15-6. It's probably not that far off, right?
Yeah.
Hey, out of the 100 greatest matches, probably all 15 of his wins are not there and all 6 of his losses are. Frank Shamrock, who Dana doesn't like, who was, you know, in his time, you know, for about a 2-year period, the best fighter in the world, who never lost a fight in UFC, you know, and is as was one of the greatest champions they ever had. Since he never lost, none of his matches are in the top 100, even though the Frank Shamrock-Tito Ortiz match, we did a poll on our own website, and people voted the second greatest match in the history of UFC. He wouldn't put it in the top 100 because Frank Shamrock won. And, you know, like, no, I mean, he would show, if Frank Shamrock lost, that would be in the top 100. But, you know, that's the mentality. And, you know, there's like when Vince went national and, you know, all of these guys who had reputations from other places, he would pretend that they were new guys. You know, like he couldn't acknowledge, you know, like a Harley Race. He couldn't acknowledge that Harley Race was a former world champion, you know, because it was like I created the world and anything I didn't create did not exist. And Dana has not so much I create the world and anything that doesn't exist as much as if I don't like you, your history's erased.
We even saw in the 70s when his dad was running things, occasionally somebody from one of the other federations would come in and wrestle for the title or do whatever. And you'd be like, wow, hey, that guy. And once Vince really took command, you never saw that anymore. And I don't remember seeing that in the 80s really at all.
No, well, that's because Vince, you know, locked, you know, Vince.
He didn't want to push other guys.
Yeah, well, Vince Sr., the thing with Vince Sr. was Vince Sr. was friends with every promoter, and the promoters kind of worked together. And then Vince Jr., you know, I'm going into your, you know, Vince was just like, you know, no one's my friend, everyone's my enemy. And Dana's like that, too, in the sense of, you know, what Dana, you know, would do is, and it's what Vince would do with WCW. You know, Dana, when Affliction or Strikeforce on Showtime has a big card, you know, he'll put, you know, like, you know, the Brock Lesnar-Randy Couture tape on Spike head-to-head, you know, and do like 8 straight hours of UFC programming, and Spike's a very willing partner. They love to do it. So, I mean, they always counter – they counter-program the other MMA shows. They don't counter-program professional wrestling.
And UFC's kind of made Spike to some degree, right? Sure seems like it.
They carry – you know, I mean, Spike did better when they had WWF before UFC because, you know, the one thing is from a television rating standpoint, I don't think UFC will ever beat WWF because there's of that weekly soap opera aspect of WWF. As far as selling tickets to events, pay-per-view, they're killing them already. So for a network, but that's a double-edged sword because you can, you know, wrestling's got that bad stigma. So like the you know, you get great ratings for wrestling, but you can't sell the time for the numbers that you should. Whereas with UFC, you know, the ratings aren't as good, but you can sell the time for a better thing because there's the idea that it's a higher demographic clientele watch UFC than watch WWE. And there probably is some truth to that, too, you know. So
I got to ask you about Vince because I was watching MSG Classics. And God bless him for showing the old 70s and 80s stuff. I just love it. I have my TiVo set for it. I'll click on DirecTV and like, whoa, two new ones. But forget how long Vince has been around. I mean, is he late 50s, early 60s now?
Vince would have started in 71 as an announcer.
So he's mid-60s? Early 60s?
Vince is in August. He'll turn 64. He was born in August 1945. I don't
so
know.
How much longer does he have doing this?
It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, he's going to go as long as he can. But, you know, the list of wrestling promoters that were successful over the age of 70 is pretty small. I mean, it's like two or three in history. So
yeah.
It's a young man's business. So, yeah, I mean, is he going to go? Is he going to be on top in 6 more years? I don't know. I mean, Stephanie's going to be running the place.
I was going to ask you. So his inner circle is Stephanie, Shane. Who else?
Well, Shane might be doing, you know, Shane will be a company officer, but he's not going to be running the place. Stephanie will be running the place with Triple H. And hopefully by then, Triple H, I don't know if he'll be wrestling or not, but I will say this. Triple H will break Ric Flair's record for most times being world champion. That's a lock.
Just because he can.
Exactly.
So Stephanie and Triple H running the WWE. That's bizarre.
Yeah.
I can't even come up with another parallel to this.
I don't know. Didn't like the widows of some football owners, and didn't like Georgia Frontier run the Rams?
Yeah, true. But I mean, it would be like if David Stern stepped down from the NBA and turned it over to his son to his daughter and.
Her boyfriend.
Know, run our test. Yeah. It would just be so strange.
Yeah.
All right, last question. Your Wrestling Observer newsletter, you're really like light years ahead of your time with this thing. And you resisted going on the internet. You were sending it out. I think we even talked about it 2 years ago. Now you can get it online. What changed? What made you make the decision?
I had no choice. You know, I mean, sooner or later it was gonna happen, and I probably think that I went a year too late for it. I mean, as far as, you know, the right time was probably a year earlier, but I probably have always moved slow in that way. I mean, if I had done it 2 years earlier, it probably would have been bad, but a year earlier, when I look back, probably would have been, probably optimum. No, it's just when you, to reach a younger generation, I mean, the older readers are fine with the print, and they love getting it in the mail on the weekend. And, you know, I'm retaining most of them, but some of them are losing interest in wrestling. Thankfully, because of UFC, a lot of them are switching, you know, are retaining interest because they like the UFC if they don't like wrestling. And some, you know, and it's still 75% pro wrestling that I'm covering. So,
it's a pay website.
Yeah.
How have you been able to keep people from either copy-pasting and all that stuff? I mean, what kind of obstacles are you finding on that front?
It's a drag, but, I mean, so far it's worked. I think a lot of it's because we do the audio stuff, and, you know, we do 3-4 audio updates a week, and I think that's a big lure right now is all the audio, you know, because, you know, yeah, you can – the news, it's tough on the news because I can break a lot of news – But the point is, if I do, it's going to be on every website the next day anyway. So a lot of it is just the audio and the opinions and just discussing the shows and things like that. And, you know, that stuff you really can't, you know, copy and paste as much.
Well, you know, I was a subscriber until my wife said, it's either the newsletter or me. She just was like, this is it. I'll let you watch it occasionally, but if you're going to read for an hour, if you're going to read a newsletter about wrestling, I'm out. And I had to make the choice. But now that you're online, I wonder if I could kind of sneak back in and she won't find out. I think this is what I do. So it's F4, the number 4, WOnline.com. F4W.
Yeah, or you can just go wrestling, you know, wrestlingobserver.com, and it'll switch to F4Online.com anyway.
That's a lot easier. Wrestlingobserver.com.
Yeah, just go to wrestlingobserver.com, and you're on the site. They'll tell you how to get the newsletter, the audio shows, and you know, we're gonna have tons of coverage of UFC. We'll have the press conference up. We'll have a audio show the night right after, you know, Friday night. We'll discuss how everybody looked at weigh-ins. Oh,
excellent.
the last time I did that, I. You know how you can, you know, when you watch a fight, you know, I when I see these guys all the time, I can tell, like, you know, how the training's varied and things like that because the body changes slightly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was a bodybuilder and I can see that. So there was the Brock Lesnar Couture fight. I could tell that Brock had an injury, you know, and he had not been doing the sprinting that he normally did. So, Brock's injured. Randy's going to, you know, Randy's got a good chance to win. Plus, Brock was so nervous the day before. He was just walking around. And he'll admit it. He was scared to death because, you know, it's like, oh, my God, I'm fighting Randy Couture in my fourth fight. But, you know, Brock goes and wins on a knockout, and I still haven't heard the end of that one.
That's funny. So now you know, no longer trust weigh-ins. I forgot to ask you a question. So even though I already asked my last question, I have one more quickie. The PEDs and the wrestling, like, we just don't even care anymore. It's just we assume these guys are doing whatever, and they're going to die every once in a while, and we've all come to grips with this.
Well, here's the deal. With TNA, they don't test at all, and the guys do whatever they want to do. With WWE, they test everyone, and it's one of those things where, you know, there's so many things. You know, I talked to a lot of those guys, and boy, you know, they believe the testing is real for them, but a lot of them are skeptical the testing is real for the guys that they look and look the same, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And so the use of steroids in WWE is way down. As far as, you know, PED, growth hormone and all that, I mean, the rich guys are probably all still using because there's no way to catch. And I think that we just, you know, I think
just
that we
shrug our shoulders.
You know, it's not going to change. You know, they're not the only ones, and they're no longer the worst offenders of it. I mean, there was a period in, like, the late 80s and even, again, you know, up until Benoit, really, where they were, you know, right up there with the worst offenders. And let's face it, I mean, guys were dropping dead in wrestling a lot quicker than they were in, you know, anything else I've ever heard of. You know,
yeah, it was at, like, 10 times the rate, basically.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And, you know, there's still... You know, I still write obituaries of young people, you know, pretty regularly. So I just think that people have grown numb to it because I think that they started growing numb to it realistically like 11 years ago. But Eddie Guerrero and Benoit were, you know, one Eddie Guerrero was like so big when he passed away, and Benoit thing was like the, you know, the worst crime in the history of any athlete in our lifetimes.
Yeah.
So that kind of moved people, you know, and the Benoit especially. But, you know, now it's 2 years later, and, you know, I think that people just expect that we're going to have, you know, a half a dozen deaths of guys in their 30s and early 40s in wrestling, and that's just wrestling. I mean, it's terrible, but it's...
This is something you've probably dealt with from the minute you started writing about wrestling, right?
Well...
I mean, it wasn't as overt as it is now, but at the time, you got to, you know, I was watching the MSG Classic with superstar Billy Graham from 1977, and we learned afterwards that this guy was using steroids all the way back then. You know, and in baseball, people seem to think steroid use definitely only started with McGuire and Canseco in the early 90s, and, well, superstar Billy Graham was doing it in the mid-70s, so how do we know that this stuff wasn't everywhere? I've never gotten
an answer
to that.
Well, I mean, the weightlifter started in the 60s, and steroids were around in wrestling in the 60s, but they got real they got one wave of popularity in the late 70s because superstar Graham got so big and everybody wanted to, you know, wanted to emulate him. And then really hit it big in 84 when Vince went national because, you know, I mean, Vince was a bodybuilding freak, you know, promoting wrestling. So the wrestlers knew, well, we better look like bodybuilders.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I've never been able to really get the full timeline, but you think about that superstar Billy Graham, and you're talking about a guy who was the champ in 77.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, for people to think that this stuff definitely wasn't around in baseball back then, I think it's naive.
Well, I'll tell you, it was definitely around in football because the Chargers were the first team that, you know, distributed steroids on their training table, and that was like with that was 61, 62.
Yeah,
and there were players on, and there were players on the Chargers that had health problems. And you know what's funny is you know, when Ernie Ladd died from cancer, you know, he was 68 years old, and nobody thought of it. I'm going, like, he was on those Charger teams. I mean, maybe, I'm not saying that, you know, maybe he would have lived to be 78. You know what I'm saying? I mean, maybe it had nothing to do with it whatsoever. I don't know, but I'm just... When you know, it's you know, or Dick the Bruiser, who was one of the earliest steroid users, you know, he died at 62. People didn't really look at it, but it's like, you know, maybe he would have lived to be 75.
Well, the one thing we can all agree on is that Dusty Rhodes was definitely not on steroids. we're all going to agree on that one. I don't know if he could have had those man breasts, they wouldn't have been as big, or maybe they would have been even bigger. I don't know.
Yeah, look at the, you know, the funniest thing is, Dusty's got to be 400 pounds now. I mean, it's Dusty's got to be 400 pounds now, and he's 64, 65 years old. He outlasted 75% of his contemporaries.
Yeah, that's true. You wouldn't have gotten good odds on that in Vegas, I don't think, in 1982. All right, Dave Meltzer, thanks so much. Enjoy UFC 100, and we will talk to you a lot sooner than 2 years from now.
Okay, great. I hope you have a good time watching it.
I hope I do, too. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.